First of all, those of you who went on and started to read Exodus, you should only feel grateful because that means you did more Torah study. But let me just, for the record, since the Torah classes are all on tape, let me summarize the decision of the class here. By virtually unanimous decision.
And no pressure whatsoever.
No pressure. Did I mention your cut of the royalties, by the way? We decided to continue with the book of Samuel, and that is the story of David. Now, let me actually just say a few words about this to get us started. One is that the book of Samuel obviously starts off being about Samuel. David doesn't come in till well into the book, because David is the king after Saul. So what I think I'm going to do is to basically summarize much of the beginning of the book until we get to the story of David, or we may read a couple of passages specifically. But I would suggest one of two translations for David. One is this book. You guys missed the voting. And I know at least one person would have voted with you, but you missed the voting. We're going to be continuing. Let me just explain what happened. We're going to be continuing, yes, with the book of Samuel, the story of David. We're going to do that for two reasons. One is that most people don't know it because they don't study it in synagogue, because we don't read it in synagogue, so rabbis don't talk about it, and therefore the second most central figure in Jewish biblical history next to Moses is, or maybe third, Moses and Abraham, depending on how you slice it, isn't really well known to most. You go to Israel and you see the city of David, but if someone asks you, tell me the story of David, you can say, I know about Goliath and David's slingshot, but I don't really know David's story. That's one reason. And the second is that I'm going to be doing a book for the Yale University Press on David, so it will be helpful to me to go through David's story with you and to discuss it. And also in the course of it, obviously I'll be doing a lot of research and I'll know something about it because I'll be in the process of writing the book. So for both reasons, and also because I have to say, for those of you who have read it, David's is the most intricate, certainly the longest, the most complicated, and in some ways the most fascinating story in the Bible. The story of David has, it has intrigue and a lot of family drama and a good deal of sex, most of it illicit, and also the destiny of Israel is bound up in it in a very dramatic, immediate way. So it's really worth knowing and worth having some sense of. And as I said, next time I'll maybe, and it won't be next time, by the way, we don't have a class next week, but we have a class the week after, because next week I'll be at the TED conference in Long Beach. The next time I'll give you a summary. Right now I'm going to bring you up to David. That is, I'm going to go through the rest of the Bible fairly quickly to get to the David story, and then next time I'll give you a summary of what happens in the book of Samuel before David. That is the story of Samuel and Saul. And then we can continue with the actual David story. And also, the other thing is that David is, in his way, and I'll return to this theme again and again, well-rounded is not the best way to put it. He's the most comprehensive figure in the Bible. Because if you think in your mind of all the things David was, he was first a prodigy, he was clearly a warrior, he was a lover, he was a husband, he was a father, he was a king, he was a musician, he was a poet, he was a disciple, he was clearly a betrayer, he was a kind of godfather, and he was the father of a king, the only other king, Solomon, who managed to keep the kingdom together successfully. So he's the most complicated figure, at least the way the Bible portrays him in the Bible. And that's also one of the reasons why he's so fascinating to study and interesting to write about, and why when they asked me what biblical figure would you like to write about, for me it was Moses or David. I mean, almost nobody else comes close to the two of them in terms of the grip, at least. The closest next to that is Jacob, but Jacob was actually already It hasn't been published yet, but Yair Zakovich, who's a scholar in Israel, writing the book on Jacob. So the one good thing about Jacob is his story is shorter. And that would have been helpful, because you have to compress a lot to tell David's story, and really to tell it in, these are the Yale University Press Jewish Lives are all short books. They're all 200 pages or less. So I'm going to have to leave out some of the details about David, but that's okay. Also because the rabbis, as you can imagine, we know already that they fill in lots of stuff. So a lot of the stories that they tell about David are not like the famous story. The first story I think I ever heard about David when I was a kid was how he hid in this cave from Saul, and Saul came looking for him to kill him, which does happen, and that a spider wove a web around the mouth of the cave. So when Saul's men came to it, they said, well, he couldn't be in there because there's a spider web around the mouth of the cave. And so they moved on. But that's a rabbinic story. It's not a story in the Bible. So David it is. Let's bring ourselves up to that story. And then next time up to the story of the book of Samuel. First of all, just to remind you, the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, is what's called a step canon. A canon is a library of sacred books. We know that for a long time there was a debate about which books would make it into the Tanakh and which wouldn't. So there was a debate about the Song of Songs, for example, because it's basically an erotic love poem. The canon is when it gets settled, which books are sacred and which books aren't. And you may know, by the way, that what books are in the Hebrew Bible differs. The Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish Bible are not exactly the same, because there were books that were written by Jews in ancient times that were pious, and people debated whether they should go into the Bible or not. The Book of Tobit, the Book of Judith. I mean, there are other books that are Jewish books, and they're ancient books, but they didn't make it into the Bible for a variety of reasons. Anyway, the canon is, first of all, the five books of the Torah, the books that are in the scroll, from Genesis through Deuteronomy, from Bereshit to Devarim. But right after that is the book of Joshua, and then the book of Judges, and then the two books of Samuel. Okay, that's the way it works, and it's chronological. So there's the Torah, then there's what's called Nevi'im, the prophets. But as you can hear, the prophets start off with historical books. First they go from Samuel, who's considered a prophet. I mean, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. But those are really historical books, even though they include the doings of some prophets. And then you get the prophets, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, and all the what are called the minor prophets, because they have little books. And then you get what are called ketuvim, the writings. And the writings are all those books that don't fit in the other categories. Psalms, Proverbs, the Megillot, Ruth, Jonah, Job, Ecclesiastes, all these books. And if you have the JPS Tanakh, right? That is Torah, the T is Torah, the Nun is Nevi'im, the prophets, N, and Ch is the ketuvim, right? It should be Tanakh, as it is in English, but as you know, if you know Hebrew, it gets often to ch at the end of the word, right? So it's Tanakh. And that's the entire Hebrew Bible. We think of the Torah as just being those five books, but it's not, right? That's why when we read the Haftarah comes from Nevi'im. When we read the Jonah, Jews have a very fuzzy idea. They know Jonah somehow is a sacred book, but it's not the Torah, but it is the Torah. The answer is, if you use Torah in the broadest sense to mean all the sacred scriptures of the Jewish people, of course it's Torah. But it's not one of the five books, okay? So all of this is, all of Tanakh, if you are quoting in the Talmud, when it quotes Tanakh, when it quotes the Bible, it always quotes from all of these, and all of them are sort of equally, even though in theory, Nevi'im and Ketuvim are a lower level of inspiration. The truth is they all count, right? We get law from all of them. We get teachings from all of them, so on. So, and the assumption is that they all harmonize with each other, even though they don't harmonize very well, different parts of it. Anyway, the story of the Torah is known to you, I assume, which is that when we left off, Jacob blessed his kids. Then what happens is that there arises a Pharaoh who doesn't know Joseph. That's the way the Torah puts it. And gradually the Jews are enslaved in Egypt, but the Torah doesn't really tell us how that happened. It just says that the Pharaoh became afraid because there were so many of them. So they eventually become enslaved. And as a result, God, after a couple of hundred years of slavery, because God doesn't answer right away, God eventually takes note of the Israelites, and there are, of course, the plagues and the crossing of the sea, and then they come to Sinai, where Moses receives the Torah in what form is not entirely clear, because nowhere in the Torah does it say every word in this book was received by Moses. Right? It doesn't tell us that. That's the rabbinic assumption, but it doesn't actually say that in the Bible itself. Among the reasons that it doesn't is because you understand that if Moses receives the whole Torah at Sinai, the whole Torah, it poses a very difficult problem, which is, did he already know that Korach was going to rebel against him years later? And if he already knew that, then he was just following a script, right? He just said what he already knew was going to be said, and on and on and on and on. So it seems like there was some kind of continuing revelation, or what happened later got written later, or anyway, it's a problem. So they cross the desert, and in the course of crossing the desert, they build a mishkan, which is a portable tabernacle, which is going to be the model eventually for the temple. Okay, the priesthood, which is Aaron, comes from the line of Aaron, gets developed in readiness for this job when they enter the land of Israel, and then Moses, in the last book of the Bible, gives his last speech to the Israelites at the foot of the land. Now, if you ask most people, most Jews, what happens when they get into the land, that's where we sort of go blank. Because we know the story of going to the land, but we don't know exactly what happens when we get into the land. We have some scattered stories, like Joshua somehow knocks down the walls of Jericho. But more than that is very unclear. Because if you read the book of Joshua, it's basically a series of treaties and battles. And that's not so, I mean, it's not as dramatic, as inspiring, as so on. In fact, the book of Joshua played a sort of subordinate role in, that is a lesser role in Jewish history until the modern state of Israel. When all of a sudden, the book of Joshua meant something again, because in fact, Yigal Yadin, who was both a scholar and a general, used the Bible to find old military roots for Israel's wars. Because nobody knew the land to fight with before 1948, but Yadin thought, you know, he could find out the way, the paths that people used to use by studying the Bible. So the book of Joshua became relevant again, and they started to study it again because people wanted to know about the battles and where Israel fought and what strategies they used and all that sort of thing. As much as warfare had changed, some things remained the same. That being the case, what happens in the book of Joshua is basically that the conquest begins. But it doesn't work the way we assume it works when we're reading the story, which is you're going to go into this land, I'm going to give you this land, and it'll be yours. It's a long, slow, laborious process that, as I said, is a combination of battles, sometimes local battles. And by the way, some battles the Israelites win and some battles the Israelites lose. And treaties with local tribes. So we don't think about it this way, but if you think about it, if for a minute you forget the idea that God sort of cleared out all the inhabitants and just stuck the Israelites in there, you realize that there must have been a lot of assimilation along the way of people to the Israelites as they conquered. It's not, I mean, even though it says in the Torah, you know, you'll wipe out all the people of the land of Israel, it clearly didn't happen that way. When you read the book of Joshua and the accounts of the battles, what clearly happened was some people joined, some people fled, the exact same thing that happens in every battle. And so when we're talking about, I mean, it's funny, there are all these tribes. Yehuda Amichai has a beautiful poem about how the hills of Jerusalem whisper the names of all these tribes that only exist as tribe in the Bible as tribes that used to live in the land of Israel, right? The Jebusites. I mean, but the truth is, some of us could have Jebusite blood. I suppose by now it would be an infinitesimal amount, but we could, because the chances that all the Jebusites were killed are small. What probably happened was some Jebusites somehow, once the Israelites were clearly the conquering tribe, they assimilated, they joined the Israelites, they married the Israelites, they had kids with the Israelites, all those sorts of things. And that's the picture that you get from Joshua and even more from Judges. What happens in the book of Judges, and you know some of the judges, the most famous of them, even though in some ways the least admirable, is Samson. Samson comes from the book of Judges. What happens in the book of Judges is you get a succession of tribal leaders. And that's really what it is, because Israel is not yet an organized people in the land of Israel. And they don't really have a government. And again in the book of Judges, a chapter will end by saying, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In other words, it was pretty chaotic. There was no organized leadership. There was no stable government. And you get these charismatic figures who arise and lead the tribes for a while, sometimes save them in battle, and enable them to coalesce around the leader for a while, but then the leader dies or leaves or is killed or whatever, and then you start all over again. Because the process of, if you could turn the clock back and you were looking from above, you wouldn't know that the Israelites are the ones that are going to survive. Because there are all these tribes jockeying for position, as there are, if you study ancient history, in all these ancient lands. And somebody eventually emerges as the tribe that succeeds in conquering, and that was the Israelites. But when you look through the book of Judges, just like the book of Joshua, it's not at all clear that, I mean, well, it's clear to us because we're reading the book of Judges, and we know that it's going to be a gradual march till they conquer the land. But even after the Judges, there's one very powerful and troublesome group of people that still exist in the land, and those are the Philistines. And the reason that you know the name the Philistines, but you don't really remember the name the Jebusites, is because the Philistines were, they lived, by the way, in Gaza. That was there. They were a port, they were a sea people. And the Philistines were persistently Israel's greatest enemy until they were wiped out by our hero, David. Yes. Whether he was our hero or not is a separate issue. But until they were, so even now, if we're talking about time, between the time that the Israelites entered the land and the time that David was king, we're talking probably a couple hundred years. So it's a long process for the Israelites to, I mean, we think retrospectively a couple hundred years is not that long ago, but we're talking about, what, the beginning of the 1800s is 200 years ago. So it really is a long time ago if you're actually alive at the time, and just think of the differences in the United States, just demographically and otherwise, in a couple hundred years. And even though time moved much slower in the ancient world, obviously, than it does now, nonetheless, it took a long time for Israel to finally manage to conquer the land of Israel and to make it a Jewish land. And part of the story of David, but only part of the story of David, is how he becomes the person that manages to create a unified kingdom for a very, very brief time. Right, for a very brief time. It's basically under David and Solomon that Israel is unified. And that's one of the reasons why we think of it as a sort of golden age. And also it's under Solomon that the first temple is built. David is not allowed to build the temple, at least according to one version of the story, because he had blood-stained hands, because he was a warrior. He spent his whole life fighting. God didn't want him to build the temple. Although I have to say, if you're looking for reasons why David shouldn't be allowed to build the temple, you can find lots of reasons why David shouldn't be allowed to build the temple. In fact, I remember when I was at the Jewish Theological Seminary as a student, Ivan Boesky, whom some of you will remember, who was indicted for all sorts of financial crimes, he had given money to the library at the seminary to build the seminary library before his fall. I think that's the best way to put it. And he'd given, I think, out of however many hundreds of thousands of dollars he was going to give, he had given like $75,000. And they had already put his name up on the library. And there was a big deliberation about what they should do and what constitutes a legitimate contribution and what constitutes an illegitimate contribution. And I remember that, and the discussion was actually very thoughtful and very interesting. I remember the chancellor talking about it to all of us. And I remember people making the point that actually if you took illegitimate contributions out of public institutions, you know, you'd have no museums and no libraries left in America. Because it's not as though you examine, you know, well, let's look back over your business practices and see if they were legitimate before we take your money to build our institution. But it's different because it's a Jewish institution and it's the seminary and on and on. Anyway, after various examinations of Jewish law, what they finally decided was they took his name off, which he acted very honorably in this. He said, remove my name and keep the money that I've already given you, I can't give you more money. I think he'd given $75,000, but I could easily be mistaken, I don't remember. Anyway, but I remember when they chipped the letters off the front of the library and how you could, for several days afterwards, you could still see the, you know, until they really scraped it away. There were obviously lots of good reasons why you wouldn't want David to be the name that you had on your temple, why Solomon was a better name, that the Temple of Solomon in some ways was better, even though it's the city of David. A city is a more ambiguous sort of entity than a temple. Good things happen in a city, bad things happen in a city. You don't want to name your temple after somebody who lived the kind of life that David lived, even though Solomon married 1,000 wives. There's always, you know, yes, at least he married them. That's right. At least he married them. And he didn't kill their husbands. David, on the other hand, sort of did. Sort of, because he did it by proxy. Yes, he did not do it by his own hand. In any event, the legacy that led up to David, it's worth understanding before we come to this, was first of all that there were local chieftains that ruled Israel. There was no king, there was no kingdom, there was no unified place, and out of this tumult, the most stable entity was the priesthood, were the Kohanim, because at least the priesthood was a regular lineal succession of parents to children, and they did the same thing, and it wasn't as though you just had this charismatic figure who happened to arise here or there or the other place, which was difficult because they couldn't establish any kind of, I mean, the advantage of a hereditary king is at least you know who the next king's gonna be. And that gives you a certain stability in government. Granted, parents would kill their kids would kill their parents, other dynasties would compete, but at least in theory, you had a succession of people and you knew who it was going to be and it was more or less stable. It was certainly more stable than having all these chieftains arise in different parts of the country just depending on who was the most successful warrior. And they would be the person that would prevail and rule for whatever time they could rule. And so the advantage of the priesthood was that it was stable and it was hereditary, and that's why the book is called the Book of Samuel, because Samuel was the first sort of successful priest, ruler, prophet, whatever you want to call it. He was the stable figure for much of his life, and what happens then, of course, is that the people want to be like everybody else. They want a king, and you can imagine how Samuel feels about that. He's not crazy about it, and also, you know, in the Torah, there are warnings against kingship. Don't have a king, because the king will take your money and take your wives and all, and will send back to Egypt for horses and materials. In other words, a king will just accumulate power. That's what kings do. And that's bad, A, because it's bad for the people, and B, it's bad because, after all, the power in ancient Israel is supposed to belong to God, not to a king. And yet the people really want a king, and you can understand why they want a king, because that's the only way that you can have any kind of governmental stability, is if you have a successful king. At least that's what they think. And there's got to be a reason why almost every ancient civilization that we know at one time or another had a king, because it worked for the time. If it didn't work, presumably they would have made other arrangements. But until Athens, I'm not aware that there was any ancient civilization that never had a king. Okay, so that brings us at least up to the book of Samuel. Now, in two weeks, I'm about to take questions or comments, but let me just say, in 2 weeks, you either can get a Tanakh, that is a full, or both for that matter, a full Bible, or I certainly recommend, if you're going to find a translation of the David story, Robert Alter's book, The David Story. This is just a translation of Samuel 1 and 2 with his pretty light comment. Sometimes it's more commentary on the bottom, but the commentary is very good and very clear, and the translation is very good. So we'll read from one or the other of the translations. Alter is not a big fan of the JPS translation. That's why he did his own. But they're both very readable, and either one is good, and we can use both in class, either the Alter, the David story, or the Tanakh, the JPS Tanakh. I'll try to remember to bring both. And if you want to, although, as I said, I will catch you up on the Samuel story up to then, but if you want to, you can actually read up to the beginning of the David story, which I would say will probably end up starting, since I want you to get a little bit of the sense of Saul, I would say we'll probably end up starting close to the beginning of the Saul story, which is chapter 13. That's an easy chapter to remember, right? We'll start probably at chapter 13 of the book of Samuel 1. There are two books of Samuel, Samuel 1, Samuel 2. We'll start at chapter 13 of Samuel 1 in 2 weeks, okay? But in 2 weeks, I'll catch you up with the first 13 chapters. I'll go over the first 13 chapters with you, and then the week after, we'll start on chapter 13. But as I said, any translation that you have is fine, okay? Those are just the two that I think are clear and easy to read, but anyone you have is fine, just like any translation you have of the Torah. You just need Samuel 1 and Samuel 2. Okay. What's that? Robert Alter, A-L-T-E-R. He's a professor at Berkeley, a translator of Hebrew poetry and of the Bible, and of he's written on the Bible. Very fine scholar. Yeah. Yes. You should read the first 13 chapters of the book of Samuel 1. If you look in the contents, you'll see Samuel 1, first 13 chapters, if you want to read it, but we'll go over it. 571. It's page 571, and if you have the JPS, it's page 571. Yeah.
Why are there two books of Samuel and no book of David?
Because it's long.
Well, no, because it's long, but I'm saying, why is there no book of David?
Just isn't.
Because he's such a central figure.
He is, but I guess it started with Samuel. It was probably originally one book. Samuel was the original figure, so it was called the one long book of Samuel, but they broke it up into two just because of its length. No. No. Yes. What are you asking me? That's correct. That's the entire Bible. That one's perfect. Yep. That is the Tanakh. The only difference between that and this is that this also has the Hebrew in it. But you don't need the Hebrew for the purposes of this class, so the Tanakh is exactly what you just held up is perfect. And that will give you the entire Bible. Yeah.
What is Samuel's relation to David?
You'll find out when we study. But Samuel's relation to David is essentially this. Here's the very short, just to catch you up so you have some idea of what you'll be reading for the first 13 chapters. Here's the very brief outline of the story. Hannah, Samuel's mother, prays for a son. She goes to, it's not the temple, but it's the equivalent of the temple at the time, before there was a temple. And the head priest, whose name is Eli, sees her, and she's mumbling, and he thinks she's drunk. Turns out, obviously, she's not drunk. She's praying. She prays for a son. She promises to dedicate her son to God if God grants her a son. This is to make a long story short. God grants her a son. The son is Samuel. She dedicates him to the service of the temple. He grows up under the tutelage of Eli. One night, God comes to him in a dream, basically says, you're going to replace Eli, because Eli and his children were not good priests. Samuel does replace him and becomes the head priest and de facto, that is, in fact, if not officially, the ruler of Israel. When the people want a king, God tells Samuel to go and anoint Saul as the king. Samuel dutifully goes off and anoints Saul. Saul becomes king, but is, for a variety of reasons that we'll talk about next time, is an unsuccessful king. Saul is not well suited to the kingship, not by temperament, not by, in fact, today, knowing what we, if you look at the story of Saul, this is completely unfair, because look, we don't even know the people that are closest to us, right? You don't know their psychology, so on. You can be in therapy for years, and all of a sudden, a therapist can come up with a diagnosis that is different from the previous therapist that you saw for 20 years, right? So granted that we don't know each other at all, and I'm diagnosing now as somebody who's not a psychiatrist, somebody who lived thousands of years ago about which we just have a few pages. Having said all of that, okay, if you read the story of Saul, he seems like he was a manic depressive, okay? Just saying.
In a nutshell.
Saul, in a nutshell, he was a bipolar king. What can I tell you? Because he has moods of exhilaration and he has moods of deep depression. He has, and clearly paranoid, he has moods where he thinks David's out to get him, unless, of course, David was out to get him, which is also possible. But anyway, the point is that Saul does not have the flexibility and the stability to be a leader. Yeah, I'm in the middle of reading that wonderful book by Doris Kearns Goodwin, Team of Rivals, about Lincoln and his cabinet. And one of the things that just impresses you so much about Lincoln is not only the whole point of the book is Team of Rivals, that Lincoln brought all of his very accomplished, very able rivals into his own cabinet because he had the confidence that he would never say this, but he had the confidence that he could manage even the most able people and he didn't want to sacrifice them. But that requires such flexibility and such confidence and such, you know, and the kicker of the book is, of course, at the end, especially after he was assassinated, but even before, all these men who wanted to be president and didn't succeed and couldn't believe that this country bumpkin, you know, born in a log cabin, who was a small-time lawyer, defeated them, but at the end they all conceded that he was the best among them. So that's exactly what Saul wasn't. It's exactly what he wasn't. As a result, the people begin to favor David for a variety of reasons. And so God says to Samuel, go and anoint David. So Samuel is actually the continuity here. He's the one who anoints Saul. He's the one who tells Saul, God is taking the kingship from you, which God does. And then he's the one who goes and anoints David and makes him king. So the relationship is important between the two of them. And Samuel is also, even though, again, Samuel's not a figure that most people know very much about, but he was a key transitional figure to the one stable, long-term leader of the Jewish people from the time of the Judges, where there was all this tumult. And if you want to read the book of Judges, not a long book, you can see it's like one leader arises after another, and every time the leader's done, they'll say, you know, there was chaos in the land. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes. In other words, it was a time of tremendous social unrest. Yeah.
How can it be that when he, before he passed away, he passed it on kind of to Joshua, but there was no rule or no thought on how should the government of this huge population be going forward?
My guess is that, first of all, Joshua had the charisma of Moses's, blessing. But after that, I mean, that lasts for a generation. It's like, okay, Roosevelt could anoint Truman, but Truman, who was, by the time he left office, you know, his popularity ratings were in the 20s, was very low, couldn't have anointed his successor. And also, I think that the theory of how you're going to rule a land before you enter it collapses once you actually enter a land, and especially when you're trying to conquer a land. So the most successful warriors were the ones who the people looked to. They weren't ready for a government yet because they were a continuing attempt to conquer the land and to be the dominant tribe in that land. So it was whoever was a successful warrior that they gave their allegiance to. I mean, ideally you have in the Torah a constitution about how to run a land, but but it didn't work out that way, which is one of the reasons why the Torah keeps saying, don't have a king, don't have a king, and then they get to the land and they want a king. Because the theory of how you're going to rule just collapses under the practicality of it. Well, in the Torah, there are certain things that you're supposed to do, but it's really a theocracy. I mean, it's God's rule, right, through the priests. That's really what it is, or through God's anointed chosen one. But if God doesn't anoint and choose someone who manages to succeed, then it's a problem. And also remember that unlike, for example, the founding fathers of America, they didn't come from, after 40 years in the desert, it's not like they came from a stable, well-ruled country. I mean, even Egypt, it was under a pharaoh. So anyway, they didn't have a constitution that way. And even now, there's a lot of work being done on Hebrew statecraft, on biblical statecraft, because now that there's a land of Israel, people are exploring it. But I think that it requires a lot of work to get a workable governing theory out of the Torah. It requires a lot of work, not so easy. Yeah. Yeah.
Why is it that after, I know we're jumping ahead, I'm jumping ahead, but why is it that after David there was no king, and who were the leaders?
There were kings. There were a lot of kings after David. There were many kings after David, but the kingdom was split south and north after Solomon. After Solomon, it was split south and north. There were many kings until they were conquered. Then there were no more kings because they were conquered.
Oh, I see. That's when they stopped having the kings.
They stopped having the kings when the Assyrians imprisoned the kings and killed them. Okay. Then everybody said, this king thing is not, you know, I'd rather go into the professions. So, yeah.
What's the date of this time period?
So around the time of David and Solomon is usually thought of as about 1000 BCE. Okay? And until recently, among archaeologists and biblical scholars, there was a debate about whether David and Solomon ever actually lived. This may shock you, but in fact, we have no incontrovertible evidence of the first temple. We don't, right? We don't know exactly where it was. We don't have remnants of it. And all these people that will tell you, these are the stones from the first temple, not clear that they're stones from the first temple at all. And the problem with finding remains of the first temple is that archaeology in the land of Israel, especially in the Temple Mount, is very, very politically charged. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just say, okay, we're going to just dig under the Temple Mount until we get low enough to find the first temple because, for obvious reasons. So there was a debate about whether David or Solomon lived, and then there was this about, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe a little bit less, 8 years ago, there was a very dramatic find from about 200 years after David, so about 800 BCE, there was a find of a king, and it said that he was from Beit David, from the house of David. Mm. Now, 200 years after David died, nobody would be talking about the house of David if David was a mythological figure, right? So at first, and in fact, that's so commonly accepted even by the anti-David historians that they didn't say, their argument about it wasn't, they could have made it up 200 years later, because you just don't do that. I mean, don't forget, 200 years, there's almost like parents telling children, it's that close. You have grandchildren who will remember their grandparents talking about, I remember when I was a kid, there was a king named David, so you couldn't pretend that. 200 years, not that far, great-grandparents, whatever. But also, the initial attempt was to say that it didn't say Beit David, it said something else. That was the attempt of the revisionist to rewrite, but virtually, by now it's virtually universally accepted that the inscription says Beit David. So it's weird how, you know, I think that most biblical archaeologists would say that the kingdom of David was a lot smaller than we assumed it was. You know, when we read it, we think that David had this vast kingdom, and it probably wasn't. It was probably small. They were probably basically local chieftains. But it's weird how one random thing that happens to survive can so change or confirm our view of history, because, I mean, it could easily have happened that you wouldn't have found this one stone that they found. So in the rubble of history, a lot of stuff gets sifted. And Theodore Bickel used to have this routine where he would find an ancient coin. I don't know if you ever saw this. It was brilliant. I saw it years ago. He would find an ancient coin from America, and he drew all the wrong conclusions from it. All plausible, but all wrong, from this one penny that had a head on one side, and, you know, it said "In God We Trust" and so on. And he goes on this long spiel about all the things that it tells you about America, but they're all wrong. So it's very hard to know exactly from archaeology exactly what happened, except that it seems pretty clear that there was a David, there was a Solomon, and what we know about them is basically in this book. So. Anything else? All right. So please rise.